This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You could say our next guest, Dr. Roy Scranton, has been to hell and back, except it's hard to say where hell begins and ends sometimes. He's the author of several books, many about war. Before getting his English doctorate at Princeton, Roy wrote for publications, including blunt blogs in the New York Times. Those pieces tied his experiences in the Iraq War with his awakening to our climate-damaged future. Roy Scranton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
So, Roy, if you were concerned earlier in your life about social causes, why did you join the military and end up on the ground in one of the, I would say, unjust wars of this century?
That's a great question, and it's one I hear a lot because I was an activist in my 20s, and you know, now I'm an English professor, and it's an unusual trajectory for someone with those elements in their background. But there's a lot of reasons why joining the Army made sense at that moment. First of all, I come from a working class military family, so the military was sort of always on the table as a career option in a way that it's not for a lot of people. I just grew up in that cross-section of American culture. So I rebelled against that, I guess, by being more of an activist. In my 20s, what happened was I was a college dropout at that point, and I was living in Moab, Utah. And, you know, I'd had a bike accident, and I messed up my teeth, and I couldn't get them fixed because I didn't have any health insurance. I was working a minimum wage job. A friend died in the community there, and then September 11th happened, and it sort of threw me into a spin. And at that point, I moved back to Oregon, where I'm from, and was looking at my options and thinking about what to do, and kept seeing this drumbeat for war on TV. It was clear we were in Afghanistan at that point. It was clear we were going into Iraq. So there was a combination of factors that sort of congealed at that moment that made joining the Army make sense. I wanted some dental care, right? I wanted some health care. I had to get myself together financially and, you know, in terms of organizing my life. I wanted to go back to school. But as well, I could see 9/11, you know, the events of September 11th had really changed the world as I understood it, right? It changed America's relations in the world. I could see that it changed the direction events were moving. And I didn't understand. I knew I didn't know what that meant exactly or where it was headed. I wanted to go and see what it looked like. And I did. George Orwell has always been a hero of mine. And one of the reasons why that's the case is because he didn't just depend on, you know, he did his research. He would interview people and he would, you know, read up on a subject. But he also just put himself in the middle of his subjects to try to understand what was happening, like with the Spanish Civil War or, you know, working as a dishwasher in Paris. And I wanted to put myself on the outer reaches, I guess, of American empire and see what was happening and what it meant.
Years later, in 2013, you wrote the New York Times article, Learning How to Die in the Anthropocene, and the Anthropocene is a new geologic age proposed by scientists where humans are driving some planetary processes now. And you compared your entry into Iraq after shock and awe to our developing future. What did you see in that war zone that could be in our future?
What I saw in Baghdad and Iraq more broadly was the collapse of infrastructure in the face of massive destruction and the probably deliberate or possibly just incompetent intervention of military and U.S. state actors in that situation in a way that left everyone worse off. And then the emergence out of that kind of constructed anarchy of virulent religious sectarianism, horrific violence, and vast suffering. So what I saw, to sort of condense that, what I saw was the failure of, you know, what we think of as civilization, right, on a small scale, in the face of catastrophic disaster, the failure of the military and government institutions we depend on to come in and create order in a situation like that, And then the emergence of local, unelected, increasingly more and more violent leaders in this kind of political vacuum. I think that's probably what we're looking at, right, in the future. Like, it's a small example of, I think, what we're going to increasingly see and what we're seeing. Actually, it's not as if it's in the future. We saw it in Katrina. We saw it with Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. You know, there's a combination here of failing infrastructure and increasingly unmanageable disasters and a kind of, you know, what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism, a kind of governmental and corporate and military approach that feeds on and encourages that disaster. Baghdad was a vision, I guess, of the future that I think we're going to see more and more often all over the world.
Do you think that proximity to death on a daily basis in a war zone helped eliminate a social veneer in you that might be steering you away from false hopes about climate change?
Yeah, that might be one way to describe it. It's funny, though. You know, I think about when I talk to or see on Twitter or engage with a lot of, you know, my fellow writers and journalists who are writing about climate change or activists and sometimes even scientists who have been for a long time advocating that we need to, you know, we can do this. We just need to keep fighting. It seems to me that those voices are growing increasingly frenetic and increasingly shrill, and they also sound more and more to me like the generals, the U.S. generals who were in charge of the occupation in Iraq and the U.S. generals in charge of the occupation in Afghanistan, right? These generals who insist that things are going great, we just need to stay the course and it's going to work out. But that's just self-delusion, right? That's just them telling themselves that and telling the people who they feel responsible to that they're invested in a certain narrative, that things have to turn out a certain way because the possibility that they could turn out some other way is simply not something we can face. So I think we're in a similar situation, right, with catastrophic anthropogenic global warming. A lot of people believe that, and I'm not even talking about like the right-wing climate change deniers who are just, to me, they're like intellectual scum. They are in the worst bad faith and they're horrible people. But I'm talking about people with whom I would share a lot of, you know, sort of progressive, general progressive ideas and views on things. I think there's a lot of denial because actually facing the possibility that we've lost this fight and that it's in the end game now, it's not something they're willing to face. They're not willing. They just can't. We just can't accept what that means, right? I think that's an obstacle to us thinking through what comes next.
Well, we're going to get into more of that as we get to your new book, We're Doomed, Now What? But I want to, first of all, ask you a little bit more about this military angle because, well, for example, James Clapper is a former director of national intelligence, and he was just in the news after President Trump took away his national security clearance for political reasons. But in 2013, James Clapper predicted the extremes of climate change would force mass migrations, riots, and civil chaos. And it got me thinking, how long has the military known that climate change will become the master threat and not terrorism?
Well, that's an interesting question that I have to admit I don't actually know the answer for. I do know that some lead movers and shakers in the military have been focused on climate change as a national security threat to some degree over the past 10 years, and perhaps even before then. They're not approaching it in terms of, you know, how do we stop it or what do we, you know, how do we mitigate. They're approaching it strictly as a security issue, what the military calls a force multiplier, maybe, you know, that it makes things worse, right? And it's going to drive conflict and it's going to create unstable security situations and emergent threats and so on. And it's also going to affect, right, bases like New Fork News and naval bases all over the world. It's really going to threaten American security infrastructure. So that's been a real concern. Also a real concern is the fact that the U.S. military runs on oil and, you know, how that dependence on oil relates to climate change and relates to possibly you know, other emergent energy regimes, you know, based around solar or what have you, that has become an increasing issue as well. One thing that's interesting is that the last national security planning document, so the first one under the Trump administration, has omitted, it's just basically scrubbed climate change from discussion, and it's now focused primarily on China and Russia as state actors and the control of energy, right, as a serious political and security concern. But it's sort of, it doesn't really talk about climate change in the same way that the last few policy planning documents have.
In that 2013 New York Times blog, you said, quote, "We have to learn how to die not as individuals, but as a civilization." And that got my immediate inside brain reaction of, well, who are you to proclaim the death of our civilization?
Just an interested observer. So here's the deal, right? The civilization that we live in runs on oil, right? And coal and natural gas, primarily oil. If you think about plastics and you think about shipping and you think about just the way our world, the human world that we live in, is connected and dependent on cheap oil for energy and at cheap oil as a substance for construction, and then the way that that affects the networks that we live within, then we have to face the conclusion that if we're going to move into the future, right, this civilization needs to transform not in the superficials, not on the outside, not in the recycling bins and the electric cars, but like all the way through, right? From the very inside all the way through. All the things that have emerged in what, you know, some scientists are calling the Great Acceleration after World War II, you know, that's seen such an increase in various aspects of the human world, from population to carbon dioxide to nitrogen to all these things, acres of concrete, so on. Like, the whole civilization has to change so much, right, that basically the way we live now has to die, right? The way we live now is not sustainable. If we want to imagine the possibility of a real human future, this civilization has to transform into something else, right? Which is to say that this civilization has to die and a new one has to be reborn. That's the happy, positive side of it, right? The unhappy, like, not so positive side of the question is just that if we can't do that, if we can't let go of the way that we live now and embrace a radically new future, then what we're going to just see is this civilization collapsing under its own weight and failures and inability to change, right? Because fundamentally, right, all that oil is being turned into, you know, carbon dioxide and pumped into the atmosphere, and it's overheating the planet, and it's going to, a range of second order effects are going to just make much of the planet uninhabitable for humans and so stress this wonderfully fine-tuned global infrastructure that it's going to collapse under its own weight. So those are the two ways, right, that this civilization could die. But either way, right, either way, it means the end of life as we know it.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Roy Scranton, author of the new book, We're Doomed, Now What? Essays on War and Climate Change. So in December 2015, you returned to the New York Times with kind of an update titled We're Doomed, Now What? That became a book just published by Penguin Random House in July 2018. The subtitle is Essays on War and Climate Change. Now, climate activists who came up through the peace movement have a hard time seeing that connection. You were kind of a war writer. Why are you talking now about climate?
Well, I'm talking about climate now for a couple of reasons. First is that, you know, before 2012, 2013, I actually hadn't been aware of how serious the situation was with climate change. A lot of people have this kind of moment of revelation where they read the IPCC reports or the World Bank reports, or they read a book like David Archer's The Long Thaw, you know, just where you take a moment to actually do some research on what scientists are saying, and you realize how severe the situation is, how enormous the obstacles are to transformation, and how unlikely it seems that we, whoever that we is, right, as a collective, as the human species, are going to be able to, like, actually do anything about it. That was kind of an existential moment, right? You know, not dissimilar to the moment when I decided to join the Army. Like, I was like, what do I do with this? Like, how do I make sense of this fact? I've spent this time in the Army to be able to go back to college and get a PhD so I could study and teach poetry, and then the world's ending. And now what? And so I started writing my way through it. And so that's basically sort of the way I came into it. You know, it's connected to my thinking and my work on war in a lot of ways. First of all, because climate change is, as the U.S. military knows, it's a conflict driver. It's connected to war in that kind of physical, direct way. But there's an interesting connection in that both climate change and war present really complex, interesting problems in terms of thinking about how we make meaning collectively, right? How we make meaning as a culture. War is interesting because there's so much sort of doublespeak and hypocrisy around it. It's interesting because it's a way of creating meaning in action, right, as well as in discourse. It undergirds much more of our culture than we tend to be aware of in a day-to-day way. And it's also a kind of, it's an easy atavistic go-to when we feel like our sense of meaningfulness is threatened, which we're going to see more and more of as climate change continues to emerge as the most significant global problem. But climate change is challenging in a bunch of other ways, you know, not least because of the scope of the problem, which is also a problem with war. It's a challenging problem because in distinction to war, it's not political in the sense that one can identify an enemy or a friend, right? Climate change is a much more complex problem in terms of, you know, which side are you on and who's complicit and who's culpable. You know, while it's easy to point the finger at and say, you know, there's so many corporations who are responsible for such and such percentage of climate change or carbon, and, you know, it's the rich and so on and so on, you know, especially for those of us who live in the United States, right, this is kind of a bad faith, right, finger pointing, because in fact, most of us are deeply invested in a very oil-rich way of life and are largely unwilling to make the sacrifices necessary to transform that. And then the problem arises, right? Like, even if we were willing to do so, that doesn't necessarily mean that it would change anything because, you know, there's still China and India and Russia and so on and so on, right? The world is not the United States. So all kinds of interesting conceptual problems that emerge when you start to think about climate change and how we're making sense of it, right, individually and as a culture.
For sure. My brain breaks down about some of the hypocrisy in my own life and in the people around me, even those who believe in climate change. So it's a difficult question. Now, on July 29, 2018, in a talk at the Commonwealth Club of California, you were paired with Episcopal priest and theologian Matthew Fox, and I've heard Matthew Fox speak. His website is climateone.org. And you said there, quote, "I'm all for despair. I think it's a good place to be." Could you please help us understand that?
We're afraid of despair. I think we're afraid of loss and sadness and grief. I think we live in a culture that tells us 1,000 times a day to keep moving and to feel happy and to focus on the positive and enjoy yourself. You know, I think that's often pretty diluted, and I think it's especially diluted when it comes to thinking about global climate change. You know, the situation is, even if we were to stop emitting carbon entirely right this minute, all over the world, we're still probably in for another couple degrees of warming, right? And that's catastrophic. That would be catastrophic for the world we live in, right? Coral reefs, even if we stopped emitting carbon all over the world right now, the coral reefs would probably still die, right? Ocean fish populations would probably still be decimated. The Arctic would still be radically transformed. We've possibly, and maybe even probably, already passed significant tipping points to a kind of runaway warming. And that's all That's all baked in, right? That's all because of the time lag between when we put the carbon into the atmosphere and the effects of that carbon emerging in the global climate. So even if we were somehow able to win this battle to stop climate change today, and we're dancing in the streets, it's a Pyrrhic victory at best, right? Because we still lose so much. We lose the seasons that we're used to. We lose plant life and animal life. You know, we're going to lose a lot of people, a lot of our fellow human beings, right? There's still so much loss. And until we start to reckon with that loss, and still until we start to make sense of the mass extinction going on right now, until we start to internalize and accept the suffering that climate change is causing and is going to cause, we are never going to be able to think clearly about it, right? Because our first thought is going to be to push away those things that make us afraid or sad or fill us with despair. Our first thought's always going to be reactive. It's going to be reacting against the things that we don't want to face. And so we're always going to be going sideways when we need to be in the moment that we're in. And that's why I think despair is not only a good place, I think it's a necessary place. I think it's really absolutely 100% necessary for us to sit with losing, to sit with defeat, to sit with loss and grief and suffering and our own complicity and guilt. We are part of the problem. I'm part of the problem.
Yep.
I can't make that go away. And then, you know, maybe if we sit with that and think about it, then we realize that there's still something we can do to help people around us.
So that's my next question. I mean, your new book is titled We're Doomed, and we've covered that somewhat. And then it says, now what? And do you have some answers to that question, now what? Or is that an open question for all of us?
And I'll be honest, Alex, the title is more of a provocation than a suggestion that I have a kind of, you know, 12-point plan as to how we should live with, you know, the collapse of human civilization and the death of so much that we love. I think it's a process, and I think we have to face it is the first thing, right? We have to come to terms with the situation. The hour is later than we think it is, right? We've already lost more than we thought we had. And we need to catch up with ourselves. That's the first thing. After that, once we start to do that, we can start to think about how to move into this new future with compassion and some sort of ethical responsibility, right? We're in this together, and we need to start thinking about how we're going to deal with, you know, emergent autocracy or xenophobia, climate-driven displacement and conflict. We need to start thinking about how we deal with this, not in the sense that we're just going to fix climate change and everything's going to be okay, but how do we live in a broken world that's going to keep getting worse? What does an ethical life mean in that situation? And then if we have the time, if we have the luxury at the end of the day, we can start thinking about what we might do for the future, right? If there's going to be some kind of human future, what do we pass on to them? How do we help them? You know, they're going to be dealing with problems that we can't even imagine at this point. We have some obligation, I think, to pass on what we can and to do what we can to help them. But how we do that isn't entirely clear.
So at Duke University in North Carolina, you're supposed to talk with the celebrated Indian author Amitav Ghosh. And in 2016, I interviewed him about his book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. Do you have expectations about where your conversation with Amitav might go?
I've been in conversation with Amitav over the past year, and he's always a bracing and challenging interlocutor because he doesn't really respond to kind of American pieties that we have to find a solution or that that there needs to be some kind of positive spin at the end of things. And he's also, his worldview is deeply connected to South Asia and Asia in ways that I always find really informative. He's able to see how climate change is changing the political situation in China and in India and how that relates to American politics in ways that I find always really enlightening. It's hard to know exactly what we'll wind up talking about. Probably, you know, some politics and some philosophy and some, you know, we'll probably field some questions from people who insist that, like, we need to do something now. And we'll probably both say, well, we're past that point. So I look forward to it quite a lot.
I would like to hear it. I hope it's put out as some sort of podcast or recorded. So look, as we wrap up here, Roy Scranton, do you see yourself as part of a community of like-minded thinkers? Who else are you in touch with who are thinking the way that you do?
I mean, I definitely consider Amitav an important colleague, fellow traveler, if you will. Dale Jameson is another. I feel like Elizabeth Colbert's work is very sympathetic, although I haven't had the opportunity to meet her in person. I don't know if I don't know if she would agree, but I think there's a deep pessimism about humanity in the subtext of her work that I find very sympathetic. There are many others. Some of my colleagues here at Notre Dame, like Julie Adnay Thomas and Laura Walls. There's a young writer named Samuel Miller McDonald, who's doing a lot of interesting work, short pieces so far, but I'm looking forward to seeing what he's doing on climate change and conflict. There are others in various respects.
You've given us some good tips. And along those lines, do you have a website, a Facebook page, or Twitter feed you want to tell our audience about so they can find out more?
Sure. My website's royscranton.com, and my Twitter is just @RoyScranton.
We've been speaking with a former soldier, a poet, and now author, Roy Scranton, and I'll put links to his new book, We're Doomed, Now What?, and other info in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, or as he says, you can check out royscranton.com. Roy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on, Alex. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Let's squeeze in the latest with three of America's top climate scientists talking about how climate change and the melting Arctic are part of the global heat in the summer of 2018 here in the Northern Hemisphere. This recording was brought to us via Maria Gallardin of TUC Radio, San Francisco. Thank you, Maria. And it was a Skype conference hosted by climatesignals.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.